Welcome to the Back Porch, everybody. It's great to have you with us today. I'm excited that I have Father Ronald Rollheiser back with me on the Back Porch to talk about his new book, Chastity and the Soul, which I have here. Father Rollheiser, it's really great to have you back on the show. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. Thanks.
I'm really excited to talk about this book. It's packed. Again, another small-ish book, listeners, but just packed with good stuff. So I'm excited to ask you a ton of questions. Before I do that, though, a couple of quick announcements. Listeners, just wanted to let you or remind you that our spring retreat coming up April 26th through the 29th still has space available. So if you're interested, hit the website, signpostin.org/retreats. We'd love to have you come spend the weekend with us here in beautiful Colorado. We also have our email still going. If you sign up for our email, we'll give you our free ebook. Hit the website, signpostin.org, find the little button that says free ebook, hit that. Please join us. We've got some really cool things coming out in that email every week, and I think you'll be glad you did if you sign it up. Plus, you get a free ebook. So what could be better? And then finally, if you haven't heard yet, we do have a Facebook group for our podcast listeners. Search Signpost In on Facebook. Look for The Back Porch. Join us. Ask your questions. Follow up on the show. We'd love to have you be part of that. That's free and open to everybody. So come on over and join us. We'd love to have you. All right. Those are the housekeeping things. My guest, Father Rollheiser, is a specialist in the field of spirituality and systematic theology. He's a New York Times best-selling author, writes a regular column featured in a lot of newspapers worldwide, author of many books, including this new one that we're talking about, Chastity and the Soul, You Are Holy Ground. I'm, as I said, excited to talk about this one. I wasn't sure, Father Rollheiser, if at first this book was going to fit our show. I was like, I don't know, chastity, not sure about that topic, as you even mentioned in your book. It's one of those things that we kind of cringe at. After having read the book, however, oh my goodness, it's so up our alley. So listeners, I think you're going to really be glad that we're talking about it. But I do want to ask you to join me, Father Rollheiser, on this updates for the Back Porch. Something that you're interested in doesn't have to be related to what we're talking about. I wanted to tell you, because I was excited that you were on, that I picked up this book. I don't know if you can see it. It's God or Nothing by Robert Cardinal Serra. It just happened to be in a Catholic bookstore. Saw the book. It was, you know, sitting on the shelf face out, and started flipping through it. And it is fantastic. So next read, after you read the book we're talking about today, pick up this one. Pretty fantastic. I've loved it. So what are you reading? What's going on in your life?
Well, you know, first of all, and I'm sure too, we're preparing here for Holy Week, so we're just a couple of days away. So that's kind of a special for us, and we won't have classes. So next week will be a slow week, but an intense week. But you know, I picked up a book that's highly advertised, and it's uneven. Oh, it's very interesting. The book called Sapiens. This guy, the history of humankind, is a scientist. There are a lot of interesting scientific facts. I'm a little disappointed. He doesn't make much room for religion in there. But it's a great learning book. And since everybody in the world has read it except me, I decided I better read it. So,
who's the author of that?
Oh, it's a long name I can't pronounce. So
okay,
look up Sapiens. You know.
All right, I'll have to look it up. I haven't read it. So cool.
And it's 400 pages, and it's heavy. Heavy reading. It's just a heavy book. You know.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. Well, as we jump into talking about your book, I'd love to hear a little bit of the backstory. Why a book on chastity? Why a book on chastity now?
Okay. Well, first of all, the first person can be answered real easy. I wrote the book because Paraclete Press asked me to write the book, you know?
Yes.
It wasn't a book I would think of writing. And as soon as they said, I said, yes, such a book is needed. You know, for a long time, and I've written a series, you know, sorry, newspaper columns for 40 years. And I realized I'd written probably 10 or 15 on chastity. Because, you know, I worry, first of all, it's a concept that's almost disdained in our culture. Mm-hmm. You know, actually, I was going to subtitle the book, "Can Anybody Say the Word Chastity Without a Cringe?" And they changed it, although that's still the first line of the book. And so just a story as an example, I was asked to come to Boston College a couple of years ago. And the dean said, "I want you to talk to the undergraduates, but talk about chastity, but take a long time work. We won't put it in the title. In the title, nobody will come, you know?" Said, so kind of work up to it, said, because that is a problem, you know? And then mm-hmm. it's not a problem in our culture. It's not just, as I say in the book, a sexual thing. This is a mm-hmm. wider problem in our culture. You know, mm-hmm. For instance, in the book, I'll get to that later, but by defined chastity, it's not the same thing as celibacy at all. For instance, you can be celibate and not chaste. You can be sexually very active in a marriage and be very chaste. My parents mm-hmm. were two of the most chaste people I've ever met, you know. See, and chastity, it's more than a sexual concept. It's about life. Mm-hmm. I define it as chastity is proper respect, reverence, and patience. Now, those aren't three words our culture works with you. Proper respect, reverence, patience. We don't have them, and we're paying a price like all over. We're paying a price too in sexuality. Like, I worry that sexuality in our culture is becoming very soulless. You know, so that there's a trivialization and so on that's hurting us all over. So as I try to say in the book, chastity is a very, very important concept. And it's all but dead. You know, even in a lot of our churches, there aren't a lot of churches defending it anymore either. You know, but in our culture, it's almost disdained. You know, you poor people, and it's identified with fragility, with, you know, with that fundamentalism, chastity for Jesus, you know, like this, you know, so this book is needed.
Yeah. As I was reading and thinking about this conversation, it seemed to me that the place to actually start was all in the book, all the way at chapter 14, where you tell the story of the starving boy. Would you mind telling that story to the listeners, and then maybe unpacking a little bit of that, because you say that the original sin was a failure of chastity. And I wonder if you could unpack that idea, because I think that's what you're saying right now.
Yeah. Okay. Let me, I'm going to get to the story, but I'm going to set up this.
Okay.
You know, I used to teach a course in Christian anthropology, and I would teach a long section on original sin. And had to study the Adam and Eve story at some depth, you know? And so you ask yourself, like, God made, you know what the story, God made Adam and Eve, what's in the garden, said, you can do anything except this one thing. You know, you can't take the fruit from this tree, you know? So you ask yourself, well, why would God make a commandment like that? And I think in the past we thought, well, you know, to test us and test, but no. As I say, this commandment, it's intrinsic, it's not extrinsic. God could not have made that commandment. So what's the command, you know? It's essentially this. And then I used the story that God is saying to Adam and Eve, I'm going to give you life. I'm going to grace you beyond your imagination. I'm going to give you, but you can't take it. You can't. There's a difference between receiving and taking. So that's the story. I got from James Mackey, an Irish theologian. He said, when he was a young man, he was once on a hunting expedition in Africa. And he said, he got up early one morning, they were all still sleeping, went out in the jungle, and he shot two turkey. And he was quite proud of that. He said, I had them buckled to my belt, and I was walking back to the camp when he sensed he was being followed. And he said, you automatically become scared. I grabbed my gun. He said, but then I turned around, and he said, there was nothing to fear. It was a young African boy. He said, naked, bloated, starving. He said, and I realized what he wanted was not me. He wanted the food. He said, so seeing that, he said, I stopped. I unbuckled my belt. I let the crane fall on the ground. I backed away. And the young boy ran up, but then he wouldn't take the crane. He said, so he began to speak to him in English. Of course, the kid done said, you can take him, have him. And he said, I started gesturing to him to take him. He said, but he became more and more frustrated. And he said, I couldn't figure out what he wanted. He said, and finally the boy backed away from the crane and he stood like this with his hands out. Mm-hmm. And he waited till I came and gave him the crane. And then he went off into the woods. See, I say that's the opposite of original sin. If you get that story, you get the opposite. See the, and you know what? It tells you something about the story of Adam and Eve. That story was written long after the Ten Commandments were written. You know that the Old Testament wasn't written the way it's glued together. You know, this story was written after the Ten Commandments, and it's already an attempt to put all the commandments into one. See, it's already attempted. All 10 go into one, and it's this: you have to wait till life is given to you. Everything is gift. Everything is grace. You know. And as soon as you try to take it, it ruins it. And that's where the curses come in. They're not put by God. The man dominating over women, nature, and all that. We do that in that sense and say, all sins are sins of irreverence. Every one of the commandments. See, if you break the commandment, you are doing something irreverent. It's a fault in chastity. You know, see that if you get the story of the kid, that's the opposite of original sin, and that's the story of chastity. You got to wait.
Yeah.
Got to wait to be given to you so that you have to have the proper patience, respect, and reverence. And if you face life like that, you know, it's interesting. Put in the New Testament, Jesus gave us four Eucharistic words, and sometimes we forget one. He says, receive, give thanks, break, and share. He didn't say receive, break, and share. You know, receive life from God, break it open, give us it. Receive, then you give thanks. You know, the gratitude. And then out of gratitude, you know, you give your life away. And see, it's a movement in chastity.
Yeah. I think, so it strikes me, even just listening to you right now, the word reverence sort of has the same cringy quality in our culture, or maybe even hyper reduced understanding of it. Like, because I think many of the people that I come in contact with, and myself included, when I think of reverence, I guess the immediate thought I have is sort of a demand on me. And I have to, you know, it's very mechanistic. It's very like demanding of me. And there's no sense of something being given to me.
Yeah.
But I think what you're saying now is reverence is actually that act of receiving something gifted to me.
Yeah. And it's respecting the gift. You know, the subtitle of the book, which Paraclete Press put to it, I love it. You know, you are holy ground. But, you know, that's one of the major images of chastity in scripture. Mm. Moses sees the burning bush and he's drawn. And as he approaches it, the voice says, God's voice, take off your shoes, the ground, you're standing on his holy ground. That's before all of life. If you're in a marriage, if you're wherever with your kid, you're always standing on holy ground. See, that's a thing for reverence. You know, and see, and that is a key thing to chastity. But the other key thing for chastity is also is patience. You know, waiting. And I use the story in there, which I got from Nikos Kazantzakis, which I very much like. It's the biblical image for chastity is shoes off before the burning bush. This is a secular image, but he tells a story in his autobiography. He said one time he was watching a moth coming out of its cocoon, and he was fascinated. So it comes out of a worm, turns into a butterfly, really. But he said it took too long, and he got impatient, so he took a candle, and he just heated it so it would work faster. But then when the moth came out, it couldn't fly. Its wings were damaged because it was prematurely rushed into that, you know? See, that's the other aspect of chastity. Waiting, you don't rush it, because then if you wait, you let gift be gift. You let nature unfold the way it needs to unfold. And also, as I'll say later on, that's precisely what makes it more sublime. You know, people don't realize that the word sublimation or sublime comes from sublimation. If you never sublimate, nothing is sublime. It's precisely, I'm not sure I've used this example in the book, but I use it with students. But I get them to watch two movies back to back. And one of them is, and they're both bestsellers. So one of them was Robert Waller's famous story about the bridges of Madison County. So this was a runaway bestseller for 3 or 4 years. But this is the story. You know, it was a great romantic tale. This photographer for National Geographic. He's out in Madison, Wisconsin, looking for some bridges, and he can't find them. So anyway, he comes to a farmhouse, 6 o'clock in the evening, and as chance would have it, the husband isn't home, meets the wife, and they fall in love. But then, you know, that can happen, you know? And so they talk for a couple of hours. She gives them supper, and 2 hours later, they're in bed with each other. Hmm. And you're supposed to believe that this is the most sublime thing that could ever happen, you know? Then I get him to watch Jane Austen's, you know, Sense and Sensibility, where it shows the story of a woman who has to, in love, she has to put up with attention for a long time, for some years. And then when the tension resolves, it's truly sublime, you know? I say, you know, like nothing sublime happens in 2 hours. You don't write a doctor of pieces in 2 hours. You don't have a baby in 2 hours. You don't grow up in 2 hours. And see, so that the waiting in our culture has such a struggle with waiting, not just with sex, with sex too, but with everything, you know?
Right. Yeah. Well, you do actually use that in the book, by the way. That whole story is there, and it's really helpful because it kind of strikes me that your feedback on it, I suppose it's like the words that you're using continually make me feel uncomfortable. And I recognize that within myself, right? Reverence, respect, patience, all of those feel painful, I guess, at first blush. But as you unpack them in the book, they start to feel like, I can sort of imagine that they don't actually feel painful. Does that make sense? Like they actually are really good. And I don't really know what to do with that.
No, I think, Brendan, the thing is, you know, our society, it's hard to believe sometimes for us that virtue is its own reward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, you know, in the long run, virtue is the greatest joy there is, you know? Mm. So if you wait properly for something, it's going to be sublime. If you short circuit it, it's going to be flat, you know? So you put up with the tension, you wait, but then precisely it's sublime, you know, because you let the gift really be fully gift. And whenever we don't wait properly, you know, simple example, I know I've used in the book. Imagine a young kid, his Christmas present's under the tree, but he can't wait till Christmas. So he sneaks up the night before, opens and looks what it is. Well, he's ruined the gift, you know? Basically, it takes something, you know, it flattens the gift. When he waits that extra day and has the tension, it makes it, you know, that's just the minor example, but it's also like, I'll be blunt, waiting for marriage to have sex, you know? You know, that, like I see later in the book, chastity and sexuality actually feed each other. They're not enemies. Mm-hmm. They need to be great friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, see that, so that if you practice proper reverence, proper respect, proper patience, you know something? You're going to be happy. And if you don't practice, you know what? There may be pleasure in your life, but it's going to be flat. It's going to be soulless. Like, I really believe virtue is its own reward. If you're virtuous, the same as sin is its own punishment.
Yeah.
God doesn't have to punish anybody for sin. Sin does it to you, you know?
Well, I think that's the, like going back to the very beginning here of everything is gift. That's something so deep in my own tradition of understanding God that like God is gift. Everything from God is gift. And I love the ability. I love being able to sort of a sustained meditation on the fact that that the gift unfolds. It's not this one-time thing. Here it is. You can grab it and take it and have all the fun. No, it's like part of the gift is the continual unfolding that takes time. Yep. And that actually makes it so God himself, he sort of eternally unfolds, I suppose, which is part of how joy can be endless. I don't know if I'm off track here, but that's how I'm been.
Let me give you another just image I have in the book.
Yeah.
And this, you know, comes from a secular source. You know, as a priest or a Christian, if I preach that, they say, well, you know, so this comes from a secular source. Back in 1987, a secular educator from University of Chicago, Ellen Bloom, wrote this book called The Closing of the American Mind. And that's a good book. But so he was a Neoplatonist. He wasn't a Christian. But he begins by saying lack of chastity is the biggest hindrance to happiness among young people. Well, this is second. Mm-hmm. And then he tells you why. But he uses this great image. He said he was a bright young psychology student and he went to Cornell. Mm-hmm. And I walked into my first class and the professor, world-class professor, says, you know, he says, you come here from your parochial backgrounds, little town. She said, I'm going to bathe you in deep truth and I want to set you free. And Bloom said, that reminded me of a little boy who once told me there was no Santa or Easter Bunny. He said, he wasn't revealing great truth. He said, he was showing off. He said, so was the cross. So he said, after I got my mark from this professor, I went to see him. I said, professor, you know something? You know what I learned from you? That I'm going to forever teach the very opposite you do. And he said, I did. He said, I teach very bright kids at the University of Chicago. And all of a sudden said, look, you come in here, you're sophisticated, you've tried everything, you've been everywhere. And you know, when he said, I want to try to teach you how to believe in Santa and the Easter Bunny again, and maybe you'll have some chance to be happy. You know, he said, like, your rush and over sophistication. He said, that's a lack of chastity. You know, and I'm going to give you some heavy terminology, which I didn't put in the book, but I'm sure your listeners can take this, but it's so clear. So he says, because he's talking about the closing of the mind, he said, what's happening is that our deep symbols are flattening out. They're becoming soulless. Mm-hmm. So, like, excuse, but it's going to be really clear. He says, like he said, for instance, I'm a Neoplatonist. He said, Plato writes in his books, he said, during their breaks, my students sit around there to talk about the meaning of their immortal longings. Bloom said, during their breaks, my students sit around and talk about being horny. Said, such is the difference. You know, see, the come down, the soullessness, you know, those are two very different concepts, you know. And this is coming from a secular source, you know.
And it's like it strikes me too that that's the original lie is you can have it right now. You can have it. You can take it. And what you end up with is a very flat, bland, unpleasing thing.
Yeah, because it won't be sublime. Yeah. You know, it takes the soul out of it. Mm-hmm. No, the other culprit I try to name early in the book. See, I start by beginning to say, why does our culture have such a reaction, negative reaction to chastity? Well, because first of all, they identify it with, you know, rigidity, frigidity, religious fundamentalism, all these type of things. And partly the churches have to take some blame. You know, our catechesis and Sunday school and stuff haven't been the best, you know. We haven't had a healthy spirituality and theology of sexuality. But that's not the main culprit. The main culprit is that the drive in our culture for ultra sophistication, you know, breaking boundaries, learning more, the newest of everything, pushing boundaries. And notice that goes against respect, reverence, patience, you know. And see, so that our culture prides itself, you pride yourself on ultra sophistication. And so chastity seems like a naivete, you poor naive Christian, or you're poor naive, you know, and it's so wrong. You know, I don't think I have this in the book, or maybe I do, but Paul Ricoeur, the great philosopher. So Paul Ricoeur says, these are the stages you pass through in life. He says, you're born naive, and children are naive. Said, but then you need to sophisticate. You need to become critical and so on. But he says, but that's not the end. That's a phase you go through. He said, you need to come back to what he calls post-sophistication, to a second naivete. You know, Jesus has a word for that. Jesus calls it childlike. You're born childish. You go through adulthood. But you're meant to happiness and meaning and soul and salvation. It's going to lie in becoming childlike, not childish, you know.
And the child, it's like a child in that it's, I guess what I'm understanding you there is, it's like a child in its attitude of reception, of expectation, of dependence and waiting, but it's not childish in its understanding of those things.
Yeah. And it's already, one of my profs in Belgium had this great little line. You know, he says, I think that's in the book, where he's saying, if you ask a naive child, do you believe in Santa and the Easter Bunny? They say yes. Mm-hmm. If you ask a bright child, do you believe in Santa and the Easter Bunny? They say no. We said, if you ask a really, really bright child, do you believe in Santa and the Easter Bunny? They get a gleam in their eyes and say yes. See, you come back. That's Alan Bloom. That's second naivete. That's post sophistication. And he said, that's what I tried to bring my students to. He said, you know, they've sophisticated themselves into a mm-hmm. certain unhappiness, you know, where experience is bland, it's dull, it's mm-hmm. flat, it's soulless.
It reminds me of Chesterton in Orthodoxy talking about he has a chapter titled The Ethics of Elfland. And he basically says the same thing. He basically says that everything he needed to know about the world, he learned in the nursery, because that's where he learned that there were elves everywhere and brownies behind everything. And, you know, like there were, that the whole world was magical. And the ethics of Elfland is precisely this ethic. It's precisely the ethic of the world is beautiful and magical, but it has to reveal itself to you. You can't go out and control it. Yeah. And that's a really,
You know, or in terms of the chest, it has to give itself to you as gift. If you're controlling it, you're manipulating the gift, you know?
See,
it'll give itself to you as gift, but if you have proper patience, reverence, and respect, you know?
Yeah. So, okay. So maybe we could dig into a few like specifics then. Some of the misconceptions I think that you clear up about chastity. You say that chastity is not about denial, but about channeling. Specifically, it's not about denying our sexual energy, but about properly channeling it. I think we're kind of already talking about that. So if this is just rehashing what we've just been saying, we can skip it. But I think that language of not denying sexual energy, but channeling it is helpful.
Yeah. Let me talk about it. I'm glad you brought that up, because I think there in the churches in the past, I can speak for the Roman Catholic Church, but I think the evangelical churches and so on, we've struggled with that, you know, where I think we realize at one level how powerful sexuality is. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we've always had trouble connecting it to spirituality. Mm-hmm. And so there's conscious or unconscious denial. Just don't think about it. Just don't, you know, see, and that never works. You know, you can never repress an energy. You know, psychologists have a wonderful image I like. They said, you know, imagine you're living on a two-story house, and every time you can't deal with something, you throw it down into your basement, shut the door. That works for a while, but afterwards it comes up through the vents. You know, but see, that's what happens whenever we can't deny sexuality. I can speak for Roman Catholics. We've never had a robust, healthy, full theology of sexuality. For instance, we have a joke in the Roman Catholic Church. You know who gets canonized in the church? Celibates and martyrs. You know, well, there's something missing. You know, no wonder our culture sometimes, you know, but see, that's, you can't deny it. It has to be channeled properly, you know. And when you look at the great spiritual authors, you know, right from Augustine through people like John of the Cross, they'll say with all your energy, it's like John of the Cross used the expression. He says, our affections come and they're just like wild horses, but they come from God. That energy comes from God. You have to channel it, you know, so that if you deny it, it's gonna snake bite you. It'll come, you know, but you have to channel, lay it out in such a way that it's creative, that it respects and so on. And it'll be very creative for you. But too often, I think, we've suffered in our churches because in whatever way we say, deny it, you know, it's not. To give an example, you know, further than the book, but, you know, when I study Christian anthropology and spirituality and so on, we've really struggled to attribute sexuality to God, you know? So, you know, today the feminists have a lot of critique about, you know, God is male. That's only half of it. But notice our God is also not married. Our God hasn't got a wife. And that has implications, you know, like how do we get a healthy theology of sexuality? But we need it. We need it.
And one of the images that's coming into my mind as you were talking about, like, okay, so this idea of the energy, especially, was it John of the Cross who talks about the affections being like wild horses? Okay. One of my favorite pictures of that, actually, so I used to teach literature, right?
And in one of the image scenes in Milton's Paradise Lost that always captured me was in the Garden of Eden, Eve, before the fall, goes out and is tending the garden. But the way it's pictured is that she's like speaking to and helping all these wild things grow in beautiful, orderly ways. And it just, that's the image right there. It's like all of this wild energy in creation. And Eve, the woman, is the one who's channeling this wild sexual energy within the creation into beautifully ordered, channeled, proper ways. And I don't know, when you're saying that image just came flooding back, and I'm realizing that's because that's so different than repression and denial. It's an embracing, but it's an embracing in a certain way. It's an embracing in a beautiful way that's really creative. Anyway, that's what came to my mind. So,
you know, the first thing we always need to say about sexuality as Christians, that it's good. It comes from God. Yeah. It's sacred. Yeah. It's a wonderful power. And it's given to us precisely. Also, it's given to us for enjoyment, for pleasure. That also comes from God. But what we need to teach that more, and at the same time, protect it with chastity. It's something sacred. It's something sacred. You know, I tell this story at the end of the book, you know, about sexual awakening. You know, when I was a kid in middle school, one day some older boy sat us down and he explained the birds and the bees to us, you know, kind of had his information down or whatever, wasn't that good, you know. And of course, that stirs all this stuff in you. But I still hadn't had the talk with my mom and dad, you know. And it ended up, I didn't get a talk from my mom and dad, but my mom got a pamphlet from church, which I remember reading, and I was, you know, 12, 13-year-old boy and so on. But anyway, it was a little bit pious, but to this day, it's marked me. It says, sex is sacred. It's good. It's for God. It's a sacred power. And you have to cherish it, but you have to protect it, and you can't abuse it and so on. Those are true principles. Those are true principles. Yeah. And it overlaid the childhood in the playground, learning about the birds and bees. And, you know, I feel sorry for kids who grew up watching pornography, you know, like what that does to them spiritually, you know, not just to do with sex and so on. We always have to, we can't affirm it too often. Sex is wonderful. It's beautiful. It's sacred. It's a gift from God, and it's inside of God.
I think we struggle so much to teach a healthy sexuality, partly, I mean, obviously, because we're surrounded by a culture that teaches a very unhealthy sexuality on all levels, even if it's not about sex, right? I mean, just even the immediate gratification of any desire is a way of unhealthily teaching about chastity and or denying chastity. To me, that's the, we definitely need to talk more about it appropriately and affirm it. But I also think we're desperate for role models. We're desperate for, well, this actually kind of goes into my next question, which is helping children especially learn you talk about the phrase carrying the tension. And I think that really got me as like a new way of understanding what's happening as I'm practicing chastity in any realm of any pleasure. I'm just going to throw two ideas at you that way. One is just maybe unpack that idea of carrying tension, which again, I think we're already doing, but I think you connect it to the contrast between pondering and amazement. Mm-hmm. Is that a fruitful direct? Cause that was a really powerful thing too. Yeah. So unpack that for us.
Yeah. Let's start with where you start with the first question, you know, the carrying of tension. And, you know, you yourself, what you said before tells us where our culture is at. Our culture, immediate gratification. So, you know, when you gratify me, you know what you're doing? You said, I'm not carrying any tension. I'm not going to wait. I mean, waiting and stuff and patience is tension. But our culture is, I don't wait. So that we have this immediate gratification where we don't carry tension. Now, biblically, that's a very rich image. You know, in the New Testament, in the Gospels, they say Mary pondered these things in her heart you know, and and the crowd were amazed. Okay. It's interesting. In the Gospels, the word crowd is almost always pejorative. It's almost always bad. Like scholars say, when you have the word crowd, you add the word mindless. Mindless crowd. See, because what crowds do is they simply conduct energy, whether it's, you know, ideology, the latest fad, the latest whatever, you know, simply, you know, it's a mindless thing, you know. And
since it's a soulless thing, soulless.
You know, there's some beautiful contrast, for instance, to in John, where the story of the woman caught in adultery, you see, they had contrasted. Jesus was alone, they said, and a crowd brought a woman. And then when Jesus dispersed, they said, they went away one by one. See, they came as a mindless crowd, but they went away sober, you know, see, so that, and when they say the crowd was amazed, it's just, and Jesus also said, don't be amazed. See, now pondering in scripture is not what it means in English. See, for English, like our software in the Western language is Greek. And for a Greek, to ponder is to think deep thoughts and you meditate and you write up lists and so on. You know, for a Hebrew, it simply meant to carry and transform tension so that stuff comes and you have to digest it and ingest it and let it work itself out. And in the meantime, you're carrying tension. So I'll give you an example. One of the best example of it is Mary under the cross. In John's gospel, it said when Jesus was dying, Mary stood under the cross. And notice she doesn't say a word. She doesn't say a word. But first of all, in Hebrew, to stand a position of strength, notice she didn't collapse under the cross. She didn't go into hysteria, you know. But she doesn't speak, which is very interesting, you know. How much different the scene would be if Mary had been under a cross shouting, "You're all murderers. You're terrible people." You know, she'd have been right with the crowd energy. You know, so you know what Mary was doing under the cross? She was basically in her soul, said, "Today I can't stop the crucifixion. Nobody can. But I can carry some of the, you know, the tension and anger and bitterness and jealousy and transform it." So my image of pondering is, see, the image of amazement is the electrical wire. It simply conducts what goes through it. Pondering, I know it's a mechanical image, but it works. It's a water purifier. See, a water purifier takes in water with dirt, with toxins, with poisons, and so on, and it gives back just the pure water. It holds the dirt inside of itself, you know? And that's what we're called to as animals, as Christians, and as human beings. You know, I'm not sure if I have this story in the book, but there's a Czech writer called Ivan Klima. And he wrote a book some years ago, which I quote in The Holy Longing. It was called My First Loves. It's an interesting book. He was writing out of Czechoslovakia under communism, and he was an atheist. And he wrote this book, and he says he grew up in Prague, and he says all his friends were sexually promiscuous. It just kind of, it was the culture. And he said, I had no religious beliefs. He said, but I couldn't give myself over to that. I just couldn't. He said, just felt I can't do this, you know, and they would say, well, you're just uptight or whatever. And then he ends the book. He has this great line. He says, when I die and I come before God, if there is a God, he said, will God say to me, Ivan, why didn't you live your life? Or he said, or will God say, thank you for carrying your solitude at a noble level? Isn't that a great line? For carrying your solitude at a noble level. See, that's another definition of chastity. You know, you're carrying, so he carried this tension, but it makes nobility of soul. You know, you read this guy, he may be an atheist, but say, I think I'd want this guy as my friend. He's got a big heart. You know, he's got a, there's a nobility of heart to him. He didn't even know why he was doing it, other than he has this moral sense that I can't violate these boundaries. You know?
Well, and well, like, that kind of just keeps circling back on stuff we keep like unpacking it more, which is the pondering. Okay, so if amazement is the electrical wire, it's the crowd, and it's, as you said, it's the mindless repeating of whatever fad or exciting thing is happening today. We just, oh wow, I keep going. Pondering
is that thing that happens when paradox is appreciated. I can't resolve it. I can't think my way through it. All I can do is appreciate it. It really is what I'm hearing.
And live it. Live it through.
Yeah,
it.
Right.
And live the tension rather than giving way to the tension.
Right. And that's, yeah, I think aesthetically, I can see that that's noble.
Yeah.
I think that's hard to, really hard to communicate in any other way than by story and aesthetics. It's a beautiful way to live. And my heart recognizes that, even if as my head sometimes struggles to see that that's noble. I don't know if that makes sense, but.
But I think, Brendan, pedagogically, I think always appeal to idealism. You know, see, I love that line from Plato. He said, you know, I want to carry my solitude at a high level. I want to be a good person. I want to be noble. And I think pedagogically, it can appeal to people. You know, most people are still good. It's, you know, go to your higher self. Go to your higher self. Yeah. You know, and the more they do it, the more they'll experience the reward for it. Nothing feels better than virtue. Nothing feels better than virtue. Mm-hmm. It's the deepest joy on the planet.
Yeah. You know, it strikes me, Father Rollheiser, I was teaching a Sunday school class for high schoolers a while back. It's been a while, but I was sort of asking myself, like, okay, what, before I started teaching, what would be a great thing to go through with these high schoolers? And I was like, you know, the Proverbs. We need to just go to the Proverbs. And it was fascinating. The, you know, first eight or so chapters of the Proverbs are basically summarized in, listen to your fathers. Like, you know, you don't know that living the way we're going to tell you to live is going to be good for you, but wisdom is more precious than rubies. It's more valuable than gold. You'll be happy you did it. And then it's the story of constantly young people saying, I don't get it. I don't believe it. And then learning their lesson. And I just, that's where we are. It's like, pedagogically, you can't understand how incredibly wonderful, how sublime things are if you wait for them.
Yeah.
But if you can, I think what I hear you saying is, if you can inspire somebody to do it with the stories of nobility, then they experience it.
Or even stories of brokenness. You know, a story I share in there, you know, which deeply touched me. But, you know, for 6 years, I was the head of our religious order in Saskatchewan. So I was living in Saskatoon. And to try to keep my feet in the academic world, I was teaching a night course, University of Saskatchewan, you know, some vague thing called Christianity 101 or whatever, you know. I met a lot of interesting students. And 1 year for an assignment, I had him read a book by Christopher DeVinck, who's a New Jersey writer. And this is one of his early books, was simply called Precious Memories for a Faithless Time. Mm. And they were essays he wrote as a young dad. He had two kids, and they were just, you know, and he was a great essay writer, so it wasn't sentimental, but just really deep. Like his relationship with his kids and his wife and all this stuff and so on, and marriage and so on. So I had the students read that. The end of the semester, this young woman came in, 30 years old, and she had the book. And she had tears in her eyes. She says, Father, that's the best book I've ever read.
Mm.
She said, I grew up with no religious training, no moral training. She says, and I've slept my way through two Canadian provinces. You know? She said, now I realize what I want is what he has. She says, I want the marriage bed. She said, I want my sexuality to take me home. She said, up to now, every time I've had sex, I've gone home. She said, what's wrong with that? It's got to be home. But she was just inspired by these essays of a young dad and his kids. And of course, that's what I want. You know, I'm sick, you know, just sleeping around and going through a couple of problems. Said, you know, said, I know what my soul wants, you know.
Yeah.
I want.
Yeah, that's.
See, so it, good stories, or like Kleeman, just, you know, appeal to idealism.
Yeah, that's good. Well, as we kind of wind down here a little bit, one thing I want to make sure we don't miss talking about, which is so, like, I think really powerful in our day and age right now. Like, it's like the question of our time in some ways is the relationship between power and sex. And you talk about this, you essentially ask the question,
quite that way. It's like, so precisely what is it to be, what is to be the proper interplay between power and sex? In a word, blessing.
Yeah.
And everything today seems to be about either complete unrestrained sex or power. So these two things are really connected. Can you unpack that? What is the interplay between the two?
Okay. I want to start this way. You know, the Me Too movement, which is very second in the, I say in the book, that's actually a movement for chastity. These are women saying, I don't want any more to be not respected, taken advantage of, and so on, and used by power, you know? So I used it as an example, like, for instance, the people who, Harvey Weinsteins and Matt Lauers and these athletes and stuff, you know, all these women and so on. First of all, by them using power to have sex with women makes the women rules their lives in some ways, but also makes them less human and everything else. No. The opposite of that, you know, is when you're in power, you can help to empower other people. And that's what it means to bless. So a Hollywood producer, Harvey Weinstein, when he's attracted to these young women, if he would help their careers and help them and stuff, you know, he'd make them happy. He'd make himself happy instead of hitting on them. So I said, you know, to bless somebody is, you know, not blessing isn't just, you know, blessing sacred objects or something. Blessing anthropologically means that you admire somebody, and in that admiration, you try to help them. You try to give some of your life to help them, you know? And so there's an element of admiration, but there's also an element of giving life. If you've seen the movie or the play Les Miserables, remember there's a great blessing scene at the end there where old Jean Valjean goes to the barracks to bless young Marius, to see young Marius. So first of all, Marius is a threat to him. Marius is going to take his adopted daughter away, which is his last pleasure in life. So he goes to the barracks just to see what this young guy looks like. And when he gets there, he finds him asleep, but asleep in a double sense. He's asleep to the fact that, you know, he's physically asleep, but he's also asleep to the fact he's going to get killed tomorrow. When the National Guard comes out, he's going to die in 15 minutes. Okay. So remember, he prays this blessing. It's beautiful. He says, God on high, he said, hear my prayer. He said, look at this young boy. He's young. His life is ahead of him. He's asleep. He said, do this. He said, take my life. I'm old. Let me die and let him live. And he keeps with that refrain. Let him live. Let me die. Let him live. Let me die. That is, you're still young. As I get older, that's got to be our refrain. Yeah. You know, but I'll give you a biblical image. You know, in Luke's gospel, at his Christmas story, you see the difference between the wise men and Herod. See, the wise men come, they find the child, they put their gifts at the foot of the child, and they say, I can die. We're in good hands. And Herod, how much to the contrary. I'm king, there can't be two kings, I'm going to kill him. And to try to do it, he kills all the boy babies. See, the wise men come and they bless the child, and the opposite of blessing is they kill the child. You know, well, Harvey Weinstein's people, they could have blessed these women. Instead, they killed him in some sense. You know,
I think the thing that captures me on this so much is that it's, I think the cultural current, the current cultural move is to destroy power. Right. It's like to level all things and remove all distinctions in power. But what this paints is a picture of how power, quote unquote, positional difference, it can be and was intended to be for the good of everything. Yeah, and that's sexuality in its like broadest sense.
Yeah. No, that's it. That's an excellent distinction just made of. This, you know, like there's a cheaper critique about power is bad and hierarchy is bad. And no, they're not. They're good. And they're meant to be seen to the extent that you have power, it's a good thing. You need it to it's intended to help empower others. You know,
yeah.
God gives you power to help others, you know, not to hit on them. And
right.
Yeah, that's the opposite. Well, power itself is good. God is the most powerful, you know, but God empowers us. You know, you're given power, like in your present job, everything is just certain power, but the intent is to empower others. So you're right. There is a cheap critique out there that all power and hierarchy is bad and so on. No, that's the...
And it's that, like, I think all the setup we've done up to this question, and I'm not saying that that's what, this question just for me was very poignant in this moment, but all the setup we've done in this podcast about what chastity is and how it's that open-handedness waiting for it to be given to me.
Yeah.
When someone in a position of power has that virtue, that posture, you can see how good it could be and how incredibly desirable it is to even have somebody in power with that posture, and that the lack of chastity, the grabbing, the taking, the demanding, how that so perverts power. And I think I think if people could start to see that more clearly or experience it maybe, then some of the cheap critiques about power would be seen for what they are, which is sort of, super destructive because you actually remove the possibility of energy, goodness being channeled properly and for good.
Yeah. No, the critique isn't just cheap. It's also silly. It's like, for instance, parents and kids.
Right.
Imagine you have a young kid. Well, this is a democracy, you know. As parents, you know, but power is given for you to help others, you know, and power is good, you know. It's not a negative word. And see, the reactions to it is because of the abuse of power.
Yeah.
Use the expression: people throw out the baby with the bathwater. So it's kind of instead of let's push power to be used properly, let's get rid of power. You know,
that's the same, like it's the same kind of satanic trick over and over and over again, because sexuality can be so abused, let's get rid of sexuality, because power can be abused, let's get rid of power. And what you're arguing for, what I feel like we're arguing for all the time is, or even not arguing for, what we're asking for is to recognize that sex is good, power is good, but there's a right way to use it that is good for more.
You know, in fact, sometimes I pray for more power in our culture. And I use the prayer, you know, in the book of Daniel in the Old Testament, there's just this powerful prayer that I say when I'm most discouraged watching the news. And he says, look, God, he said, we have no leader, no first fruits, no kings. You know, like basically send us a king, send us somebody who can lead us out of this quagmire. Like, you know, we need God's power, you know. They want to give us a king, give us a leader, give us a president, give us somebody who can, we're headless. We're headless here, you know. Headless means, you know, there's no power.
But give us a chaste leader. Okay. Final question for you, Father Rollheiser. I want to just sort of shift completely. You've written a ton of books. The last two that you've written that actually talk to you about now, both of them are relatively shortish, which I think you both times have said that's kind of your publisher's request, which is great and wonderful. But I'm just kind of curious about your own writing process. Like, are these collections of, you've been writing newspaper columns for years, so you kind of collect it all? What's your writing process like? How do you, what are some of the principles you follow?
Well, first of all, you know, Brenda, I write two kinds of books, you know, like heavier books. So like The Holy Longing, Sacred Fire. I have a major book that publisher right now called Insane for the Light and so on, about aging and so on. Those are like thesis books. And you're shooting for 200 or 300 pages with these, you know. See, these books that do with Paraclete Press, you know, this one on suicide or whatever, domestic monastery, they're deliberately short, you know, like See, if you write a 300-page book on chastity, nobody's going to read it. You know, if you have a short little book with an attractive cover and a little chat, if you have some chats, or the same with, I did a book for them with suicide or a domestic monastery and so on. They're deliberately short. And in them, you know, oftentimes I've been writing articles on chastity for 40 years, you know, so I pull them out and set them together and do some stuff and add, you know, or, you know, and it's one way of writing a book, but my major books, thesis books are written, you know, I teach them, you know, and then you write them up and so on. And so
can I ask you one more question, like a little more granularly on your writing? One of the things I noticed that you use a ton of is obviously even here story and metaphor. I guess I'm just sort of curious about your process there. Is this like, do you go looking for stories? Do you just, is it just been, you've been collecting stories for 40 years, so you have a wealth of them available to you? I mean, what's the...
It's the latter. You know, I've been teaching for almost 50 years, you know, so, and if I didn't have stories, I should be shot. You know? No, they come to you. You know, one of a priest friend of mine who was working with the indigenous peoples up north, you know, and he, when he was a young priest, he went to see one of the elders, said, give me some stories. I went to our preaching for stories. And he gave him one of his sisters, said, the stories you need don't exist yet. You got to find them. They got to find you. You have to create them and so on. See, and that's good advice, you know, like, they like, if you preach a homily, you say, well, once upon a time, there was a rabbi, and that works, but it's not the same thing as a story of, you know, the 30-year-old comes and said, I've slept my way through two provinces, and now I realize I want a marriage bed. You know, see, so the stories have to find you, and over the course of the years, they do find you, you know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, I use stories, and as you know, in teaching or writing, you know, it's powerful. Narrative is always powerful. Mm-hmm. For instance, you ever heard like speakers like Shane Claiborne, who's, you know, actually get him sometime. He's a young evangelical in Philadelphia. He's one of the most popular speakers in North America. But basically, he's a storyteller. He just tells the story of himself as an evangelical working with Mother Teresa and starting his own community and so on. You know, it can be very, very powerful. Stories can touch in a way that you got to work the abstract thinking around the stories rather than the other way around.
Yeah, that's good. I promised that was my last question, but I'm just curious about this. Do you just fill notebooks with them and then go back and look for them? Or do you just have a steel trap?
No. And you're teaching, they work into your notes. But I want to give you some writing advice here now, you know?
Yeah.
That's practical. So for instance, okay, you're a young man, you got a job, you got to stuff. So when do you write? You know what I've been doing for the last 40 years, okay, which is older than you are, okay?
Yeah. And then not quite, but yeah.
I tried to write 3 pages a week. That's not you can sit down one night, you write 3 pages. But you know, after a year, you got 150 pages. And after 2 years, you got 300 pages. And after 10 years, you got 1,500 pages. And after 20 years, you got 3,000 pages, you know? Yeah. See, and that's doable. That's doable. Yeah. You know, not to say, well, you know, I'm going to take a day off a week or whatever. But you see, like, just say, I'm going to write 3 pages a week. And, you know, some weeks you might miss or some weeks you might write 6 pages. But when you set yourself a quota, that's doable. You know, and then after a year, you have 150 pages, you have a book.
Yeah.
After 2 years, you have 300 pages.
Yeah.
You know, so well, I'm going to leave that to you as a challenge. You know, you can be a writer, but, you know, because not everybody can just take off time and have sabbaticals and do other stuff and so on. But you can write 3 pages a week and it adds up.
That's good. That's super good. I would whole nother episode. I'd love to just dive into writing and what you do and all that stuff, but thank you. Father Rollheiser, this was a delight and I am very grateful for the gift of this time. Thank you for doing it.
I'm grateful that, you know, like, cause you know, I want that message to go out there about chastity and I have few enough supporters on this thing. This is not a very popular topic, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I highly recommend the book, readers. It actually just came out. I think it was available on March 5th. So go find it, grab it. It's Chastity and the Soul. You Are Holy Ground. We'll of course put a link to it in our show notes, so that you can just click the link and find it that way. But thank you again, Father Rollheiser, and listeners, thank you for joining us. May the grace of Christ go with you wherever the road takes you. Thanks for listening. This podcast is a production of Signpost End Ministries, a nonprofit Christian ministry dedicated to strengthening people's relationship with Jesus and walking with them compassionately on their life's journey. We offer spiritual direction, retreats, and lots of other resources like this podcast. Please visit us at signpostin.org to learn more. We especially want to thank our generous donors who support our work and keep this podcast going. If you've benefited from something you've heard, please consider supporting us by making a tax-deductible gift at signpostin.org/donate. We also want to thank Rex Daughtry for creating the original theme music for this podcast. You can check out more of his work at his website, and you can find all the links in our show notes.